Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on news, politics, human rights, and the environment. TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion. I'm Dori Smith. Con Hallinan is our guest today. He's a lecturer in journalism at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and an analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus. In his November 14th piece, Provoking Syria, Cambodia All Over Again, Con Hallinan says the United States is already unofficially at war with Syria.
There was one major firefight in which U.S. troops, saying that they were in hot pursuit, crossed the border into Syria and apparently got into a firefight with Syrian border guards and killed several Syrian border guards. There have also been reports, and fairly well-established reports, that the U.S. is infiltrating special forces across the border into Syria. So these really constitute military clashes. I mean, at least in the one case, the administration is not at all denying the fact that it did get in a firefight with Syrian guards. It was on the Syrian side, and that Syrian soldiers were killed. Comes pretty close to war.
We continue now with part two of our interview with Con Hallinan, taking up a discussion on MEK, the Mujahideen Aikauk, which seeks to overthrow the Iranian government. Hallinan has drawn parallels between the role MEK has played in developing information about Iranian WMD programs and Ahmed Shalabi's role in developing intelligence on Iraqi WMDs. According to Con Hallinan, MEK has some 4,000 fighters in northern Iraq near the Iranian border. The U.S. State Department calls them a terrorist organization. Hallinan says the United States, and in particular the neocons and Donald Rumsfeld, have thrown a protective umbrella over their soldiers and equipment.
They are officially a terrorist organization. That is, they're on the State Department list as a terrorist organization, and we're basically protecting them in northern Iraq. The Mujahideen, their tie, I mean, their support comes from the Department of Defense. And in fact, the U.S. State Department has always been rather nervous about them. But the Department of Defense, which is Rumsfeld, they're very supportive of them because they see them as a potential kind of fifth column in the case of any sort of military action against Iran. And I'll also add that the Iranians have been routinely shooting down, or I don't know if it was shooting them, some of them probably crash on their own, but a number of American drones, Predator aircraft, another one, just a kind of a long-range propeller craft. Americans have purchased some Israeli short-range surveillance aircraft called the Hermes, and they've been routinely knocked down or crashing in Iran. Now, if you're the Iranians, you have to take a look at the situation. You have this group of people who are well-armed. They have tanks and all this. These are not a bunch of guerrillas with Kalashnikovs. These are people with tanks and armored cars and artillery, etc. On your border, being protected by the Americans, and you're getting this flood of surveillance drones, which are crossing your border, and photographing what? Are they photographing? Are they looking for nuclear things? Are they mapping radar networks, which is what I think they're doing? In other words, they go into an airspace and someone turns on the radar to see what they are, and you've got a map right there of the radar system. And so if you're ever contemplating an attack, then you have someone's radar system down. You know how to knock out that radar system so that you can launch air attacks, et cetera. I mean, if you're the Iranians, you've got to think that, you know, you've just discovered somebody at your door, trying to jimmy your locks. I mean, it's one thing you have someone sitting across the street looking at you through spyglass. It's quite another when you find them, with a lockpick trying to get in the door. So, does this all translate into the fact that the United States is going to launch a military attack in Iran? I mean, the rational, logical side of me says, no, it's just impossible. This is a huge, big country. the mullahs are not terribly popular, but it's a very nationalist country. I mean, it would pull the entire country together to resist it. It's much too big a country for the United States to defeat militarily. I just can't imagine that we would do something like that. But would that stop Dick Cheney and Hadley and Bolton and all these people? Absolutely not. They haven't shown the slightest bit of common sense in anything that they do.
You say most of the information on Iran's nuclear weapons programs comes from MEC,
right,
which has an uneven track record for accuracy.
Right.
In any case, you say there is a disturbing parallel between the role MEC is playing in developing information on Iran's weapons of mass destruction and the pre-war intelligence on Baghdad's WMD programs cooked
correct
up by Ahmed Shalabi. Now, Ahmed Shalabi, right now, very controversial figure, and what we're looking at is a sort of a strange process where he's dealing with Iran and the United States.
Yeah.
So just develop your ideas a bit.
Shalabi, he's really the cat man. No matter where you throw him up, you know, he comes down on his feet. I mean, here's a guy who flees Iraq. He goes to Jordan. He starts up the Petra Bank. He has to flee Jordan because he embezzled $39 million from the Petra Bank. He has a sentence of something like 31 years hanging over his head in Jordan, comes to the United States, tarts up all of this phony evidence for the invasion of Iraq, goes to Iraq, is at one point arrested by the United States, and now there is at least an outside chance that the guy could become prime minister. Now, I mean, in a horrible kind of scary way, I find that I'm there's part of me that sort of admires this guy.
The United States has put permanent military bases in Iraq.
Right.
I understand it was something like 14 of them to begin with. How does the presence now of those bases impact what you're talking about in terms of the strategies that these countries must develop?
I think those permanent bases end up as an enormous destabilizing force. And I think Americans are going to have to begin to look at this enormous ring of bases, thousands and thousands of bases, more than 8,000 bases, all over the world, and try to understand the way that other people view those bases. They view them as projections of American foreign policy. And particularly with the group of people that are in power right now, Iraq has the second largest reserves, maybe the second largest reserve, maybe the third largest reserves, hard to say, but certainly largest reserves, some of the largest reserves in the world. And our energy policy is fundamental to everything that we do. The suspicion is those bases are going to stay there to ensure the fact that the United States is going to continue to have access to Middle Eastern oil. You know, even if that were not the case, and I happen to think that at least it's a big part of the argument, even if it were not the case, however, there's no way that you convince anybody in the Middle East that that isn't why they were there. And again, U.S. is going to have to realize that it can no longer control resources that are essential to its economy and its national security. They can no longer control them through military force. They're going to have to control, they're going to have access to them through diplomacy, which is not really a problem. I mean, you know, people are going to buy, people are going to sell oil according to how, you know, what the price is. The United States has too many, you know, sources of oil. At this point, you know, Venezuela is sort of our thorn in our side, and, you know, Hugo Chavez, et cetera. Well, Venezuela hasn't stopped selling oil to the United States. It's still the fifth largest supplier of oil to the United States, and even larger for that for the East Coast. These bases create their own problems, and going to have to be a change in policy. U.S. Special Forces, 500 of them, are being deployed in an air base in Paraguay. Now, this is not a a small air base. And at one point, somebody said, well, it's just dirt air base, et cetera. Well, actually, it's larger than the international airport in the capital city, Asuncion. And it was built in 1982. It's an enormous place. It can handle B-52 bombers and Galaxy C-5A cargo planes, which is, which, by the way, the Paraguayans do not own any of. It can host up to 16,000 troops, et cetera. So you say, well, come on, this is just, paranoia. Well, even paranoids have enemies, and the problem with it is that it's right near the Bolivian border. Bolivia is going through enormous amount of upheaval now. It has had three presidents since 2000. The major fight is over renationalizing the oil and gas reserves in Bolivia. Bolivia has the second largest natural gas reserves in Latin America. And it is 1996, the U.S. and the International Monetary Fund put the squeeze on Bolivia to sell off the reserves and sell off access to the reserves. And they did so for a pittance. I mean, $286 million or something like that. Was they sold them off for. They're worth about $250 billion. So it started with this sort of privatization that the U.S. has been pushing. And there were first demonstrations around privatization of water and then gas and oil. And anyhow, there's been a lot of upheaval. And it's a reflection of what the situation in Bolivia is. 6 out of 10 people in Bolivia live under the poverty line in rural areas. It's 9 out of 10. And the majority population is native Bolivians. And they've been frozen out of the political process all of their lives. In fact, they didn't even become citizens of Bolivia until 1952. So, this is about poverty. It's about poverty and access to power. But when Rumsfeld made his speech in Paraguay, he said that all of the demonstrations were being organized by Cubans and Venezuelans, and that all of this upheaval was outside, outside agitation, etc. This has made the local countries, particularly Argentina and Brazil, very nervous. I mean, if you recall, 1964, the United States was instrumental in helping the Brazilian military overthrow the civilian government in Brazil and establish a military dictatorship that went on until 1985. Did awful things, 21 years. The same thing in Argentina. Argentina military dictatorship received widespread support from the United States. Everybody knows about Chile. We help organize the coup. So suddenly you get people in this southern cone, they see enormous buildup in this American base, and it makes them very nervous. And again, there's a reason why they should be nervous. The United States built up a large base in Ecuador at a place called Manta. And for a long time, the United States denied that it was anything other than a weather surveillance airport. But local journalists got on the story, and it turned out that, it was a great big, huge operation. I mean, it reminds me most of a place like Longchen, which was the center for the CIA operation in Laos, and the bombing of Cambodia and the bombing of Laos. And it was a sort of secret base in the Laotian hills. So this particular base at Manta has hundreds and hundreds of U.S. troops. It has thousands and thousands of mercenaries because the United States has largely privatized the war in Colombia against the guerrillas in Colombia, has largely run it through these private corporations, which, of course, Congress cannot look at. So here's this giant base that's going on here. That base moved in, and the situation in Colombia heated up. The guerrilla war got worse. You had a coup in Venezuela, and it turns out that several leading members of the Haitian group of people who organized the coup against President Aristide were holed up there for a little over a year at this base. Now, maybe it's coincidence, But you see a coup in Venezuela. You see a coup in Haiti. You see the war in Colombia heating up. You see this big air base being built up and all these American mercenaries and military pouring into this area. If you're Brazil and Argentina and Uruguay and Bolivia, you're looking at this base here in Paraguay and you're saying, uh-oh, this seems to have a familiar pattern. Now, again, it may not. Nothing may come of it. But I don't think anybody knows about it. And I have no doubts that when it comes to people like Rumsfeld, that they're certainly thinking in terms of intervening in Bolivia. And the minute you say that it's all about Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro, well, you know, suddenly you're talking in terms of the Cold War, and, you know, our friends are, you know, whoever they are, as long as they're the enemies of people we don't like.
Now, in your piece, November 14th, published in Counterpunch, Provoking Syria, Cambodia All Over Again, I want to turn to the point you're making about Israel. You mention AIPAC, Richard Perl, the Likud. I want to turn your attention to recent stories and developments about Hollinger International, because at this point, Richard Perl is actually facing civil lawsuits over his role in the illegal siphoning of $100 million from investors at Hollinger International. And in addition, ex-Hollinger chief Conrad Black, the media mogul in Canada, is also being indicted. And that's in America. So there's been a big shakeup, too, in Israel's politics, with Sharon leaving the Likud party, Peretz now leading Labor. Just talk about the incredible day-to-day news events that we're seeing and the degree to which your view on what's going on is changing, perhaps.
Boy, hard to keep up with it. I point out that Conrad Black's has investments in newspapers in Israel, and they are the most right-wing of the newspapers in Israel, specifically the Jerusalem Post. What's happening in Israel right now is a bit of an earthquake. And I think what the biggest earthquake is, everybody says, well, it's Sharon leaving Likud. I don't think that's the big earthquake. I think the earthquake is that the Labor Party got retaken over by Labor again. And that you have the candidate for the Labor Party now who is talking about poverty as the central issue, and in fact who defines the occupation of the West Bank as a moral question, not simply a practical question, but a moral question. What's interesting is that for the first time, Sharon made a statement about the fact that we have to be concerned about poverty in Israel. And in fact, one of the effects of this kind of neoliberal Likud politics, particularly Netanyahu when he was the economics ministry, was, you know, privatization and, you know, the whole bit. And what you've had is this enormous growing gap between rich and poor in Israel, and that the poverty index has gone up sharply. And all of a sudden, you have a candidate, a major candidate for the Labor Party, who's talking about the fact that we have to address that. And now, suddenly, what it means is that traditionally, Sephardics, who were cut out of the political process by the Ashkenazi European Jews, who dominated the Labor Party, and you suddenly have a Sephardic labor leader who's talking directly to Sephardic Jews. Now the Sephardic Jews, who were always the poorest, but who lined up with Likud because they were so angry at being cut out of the whole political process by the Ashkenaz, suddenly you're going to find the Sephardic population split. The guy's already split the Russian population. Nobody ever thought that the Russians would go toward labor. Well, polls show that it's fact that there's a growing favorable part that in the Russian population, Russian immigrant population, that's for labor. So, boy, this is an upheaval. Now, does this change sort of my view of what's going to happen. Well, I think it does to a certain extent. One thing you have to remember, I think, is that sometimes we tend to think about Israelis as if they're one block of people. And in fact, Israeli society is deeply split. And I think that while one part of them sees themselves as not proxies for the Americans, I mean, the Israelis have always been very careful to do what's in their interests. And I think one of the things that I also get disturbed about is sometimes, you know, people point to people like Richard Perle or Wolfowitz, and they say, well, you know, look, these people are Jewish, and so, you know, what they're doing is that they're doing what they're doing to support Israel and Israeli politics, and I don't agree with that. I think that it is in the interests of Americans, American foreign policy, to keep the Middle East in turmoil, to have a powerful military force in the Middle East, which is an ally, and that's Israel. The first time the Israelis do something that the Americans really don't like, they will find how quickly they can get dropped. So, and I'm always very careful to make it clear that this is not about being Jewish, and it's not about being non-Jewish or Arab or anything. It's about policy. It's about basic policy. I think that the effect of this upheaval right now will be in the short run. I don't think there's going to be much progress at all made on the Palestinian side. But you suddenly have labor going back to its roots. And instead of acting like neoconservatives themselves, and totally concentrating on the question of something like Gaza, which is in some ways a diversion, but is now talking about poverty, wealth, democracy, access to resources, and moral questions about occupation, that's going to move the entire debate in Israel in a very different direction. And even if Labor doesn't win this election, you know, there's going to be an elephant in the room. And there has not been an elephant in the room for many years in Israel. And it's there now. I would say one caveat here. Sharon is brilliant at the business of disruption, at doing something which diverts everybody from what's going on. I mean, he's a general, and he was a pretty good general. And one thing he knows is that diversion is a very good tactic on the battlefield. Could you have a situation where something could happen bad with Syria, and the effect is that it would drive the Israeli population toward United Front against Syria, basically back the person who they have trust with for security in times of war, Sharon? Could something like that happen? Well, I know it sounds paranoid, but it's possible. And that's a little bit of my fear here. But I think what's happening in Israel right now is just so exciting and so interesting. And I think it's going to have... I think it's going to, in the long run, it's going to have major effects on American policy in the region as well. The Israelis are going to have to decide whether they're part of the Middle East or not. And a significant portion, certainly the Sharon people, you know, are building a wall. And they're not building the wall to keep out the Palestinians. They're building the wall to keep Israel separate from the rest of the Middle East. I think if that triumphs, that is a long-run danger to the existence of the State of Israel. I think that there are now people in Israel who are beginning to say, this is a bad idea, it's impossible, we can't keep up the burden, we are in fact part of the Middle East. That seems to me to be the only long-term solution to the Arab-Israeli situation.
Will you comment finally in a similar way about the shakeup in U.S. politics in the wake of the prosecution being waged by Patrick Fitzgerald?
These guys, you know, Libby and Cheney and the whole lot of them, you know, they've had both houses of Congress. They've got most of the courts. They've run the executive. And they basically felt they could do anything they wanted to do. And they were not subtle about it. You know, they were just open, blatant. You know, it's invasion of Iraq. You know, we're going to kick your butts, and you know, we're going to take Baghdad in 2 weeks. Well, they did take Baghdad in 2 weeks, and they still don't own Baghdad. So I think that one of the effects on this is, will it begin to remove this section? Will it put this section of the Republican Party into eclipse? Well, it may be a little early to say that, but I would say that that is the direction that it is going. And I think the sign of that was the recent vote on the budget. What's happened is that Republicans are going home to their district, and they're finding that their constituents are really unhappy. And they're unhappy about what happened with Katrina. They're unhappy about the fact that they suddenly have woken up into a country which can no longer even handle a bad storm. I mean, you have had, starting with Reagan, you have had almost 30 years, at least a quarter of a century, of consistently hollowing out every single social service, every single ability to respond, and we've been running on luck. Well, we just ran out of luck. And suddenly people see what that means when you run out of luck and you do not have a system which is capable of responding to anything but military things, and they can't even respond there. So I think the effect of the prosecution will be that it will really deeply damage these people. I have a caveat here. And that is, it also depends on what the opposition does. And I will have to say that, and I, you know, truth in advertising, I'm a registered Democrat, and Barbara Lee is my representative, and so she's very easy to, you know, to vote for. I mean, she was, you know, the only vote against the war in the House. I don't have any problems with her, and I certainly don't have any problems with Democrats. But what I've seen with the Democratic leadership is the timidity that may end up getting it into major trouble. When Murtha made his comment about withdrawing, the Democrats were very careful to say, well, that's not our position. I don't know why it isn't their position. I mean, I don't understand what they're saying. They're saying we should stay in there longer for what? You know, well, because there'll be a civil war. Well, number one, we haven't got any right to intervene in any by civil war. If you recall, the British almost intervened in our civil war. We'd have been very unhappy about that if they had done so. But two, I think we have essentially fueled the civil war. We are the source of the civil war. So why are Democrats being timid on this question? If there's going to be a change and finally run these thieves and crazy people out of decision-making positions in the United States, there's going to have to be an opposition which articulates a clear policy to the contrary. I have not seen it yet. I hope very much that it will be done, but I haven't seen it yet.
Con Hallinan, thanks so much for joining us on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure.
Con Hallinan lectures on journalism at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and is an analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus. You can also find his work online at fpif.org and Counterpunch. He's been working on stories about what he calls dark armies and secret bases, an increase in special forces and military contractors in Paraguay. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores, Radio for the People at the University of Connecticut, TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussion, WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m.